Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday. Make those connections between the headline news and the mind of Christ, designed to equip you to enter into the conversations with grace and truth, and frankly, just be an encouragement to you. So I want to give a little shout out here to a listener who communicated with me yesterday after the show, just acknowledging that that what we do here on the air every day is just a blessing to him in his work, and that he's not in a work environment where there are other Christians, and that what is played over the air in his work environment is not, in fact, Christian radio, but that he listens to us when he's in his truck. And so he goes out to his truck during lunch to listen. And so I think that's probably when he hears this program. And so just want to be of encouragement to you if you're listening right now, maybe even as an opportunity to equip yourself for conversations you're going to have with your colleagues, even in the next hour, even this afternoon. And certainly for those of you who are listening via the app, the Faith Radio app, you might be in a different time zone, and so this might not be your lunch break, and so thanks for inviting us into your day wherever you happen to be. You can listen to us at myfaithradio.com. You can listen to us on the Faith Radio app, and obviously you can listen to us live on all of our partner radio stations, and certainly want to thank those of you who contribute so generously to keep us on the air. So our goal here is to get God back into every conversation, and to do so as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, to speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day, and to do so in a way that honors Jesus, right? We can't be gospel people seeking to present the gospel and then do so in non-gospel ways. And so we're not just trying to cultivate the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. We're also seeking to be Christ-like when we share the fullness of the beauty and the truth of the gospel with other people. So how do we bring all of that to bear on the issues of the day? I write about that. I blog about that. Obviously, I talk on air about that. You can follow me on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. You can check out what I'm writing at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And you can communicate with me via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Okay, friends, I on my drive in this morning, I was hearing tragic news about another suicide bombing today in Kabul, Afghanistan, killing at least 29 people and wounding dozens more. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. Their goal, we all know, is terror, social unrest, the division of Afghanistan's fragile, infantile democracy. They want to return to tribalism that would be dominated by their particular variety of Islamic fundamentalism. But the bombings that you and your family and your friends have likely been talking about over the past few days are actually not in Afghanistan, but in Austin, Texas. And so I want to settle in here for a moment and talk about the reality of stress and distress and distrust and even fear that some of our neighbors are living in across the country and certainly around the world, and how we, as the people of Christ, can be people who demonstrate what it looks like to live in the secret of being content no matter the circumstances. And so I want to lift up the situation in Austin. Obviously, we want to be praying for everybody that's involved, but we also want to be people who use this as an opportunity to actually talk about vigilance. It's not as if now that this young man has taken his own life, as the authorities identified him and tracked him down and began to approach him to arrest him, the young man who they, 24-year-old suspect, chose, instead of being apprehended and taken into custody, he chose to end his own life in what I would describe as essentially a suicide bombing. And so the suspect in this wave of bombings that terrorized Austin took his own life with an explosive device inside his own car. And so in one sense, this closes the case. It certainly ends the manhunt, but it also does still leave investigators seeking to understand and figure out what this young man's motives might have been, try to figure out whether or not he acted alone. And certainly the concern still continues, public safety concern. Did he maybe possibly produce other bombs that are still out there? And so there's this call for continued vigilance. And so I actually want us as Christians to settle in on that for just a moment. First of all, it's not as if because this one threat has been removed, you know, everybody everywhere is now safe from every harm. That's just not true. You and I know that. You and I know that we live in a hostile world. You and I know that we live amongst a people whose hearts are desperately wicked. You and I know that increasingly we live in a society that's only going to grow more and more violent unless God would see fit to send a revival to this land and people would be restored to right relationship with him and then right relationship with themselves and then ultimately right relationship with one another. And so until then, pretty much you and I are, you know, we sort of live among, no matter how you want to, I mean, I'd love to describe this in some other way, but pretty much we live among a nation of criminals. And people's hearts are desperately wicked and they do violence to one another. And in a nation where autonomy has essentially become the secular religion of the day, which means that I do whatever I want to do when I want to do it, as I see fit. And for those of you who have read the Bible and know the refrain of the book of Judges, that pretty much means that everyone's doing whatever is right in their own eyes. Well, whatever happens to be right in the eyes of a person who is not right is in fact wrong. And so we want to be vigilant in terms of our own safety and concerns, but we also want to be people who help other people be vigilant. And so How do you guard against the evil that others might want to do to you or against you? And how do you guard your heart and mind from the evil that the enemy certainly wants to do through you? And so those are conversations I think that we can have as Christians. I would commend to you a visit today in Jeremiah chapter 17. God is acknowledging in Jeremiah 17 through the prophet Jeremiah that Judah's sin is engraved with an iron tool, inscribed with a flint point on the tablets of their hearts. That's how deep the sin is. And God says, this is his, you know, sort of, you know, fair warning here, your wealth and all your treasures, I'm going to give away as plunder together with your high places because of sin throughout your country. Through your own fault, you're going to lose the inheritance I gave you. You have kindled my anger. It's going to burn. This is what the Lord says. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who draws strength from mere flesh, whose heart turns away from the Lord. That person is going to be like a bush in the wasteland. They will not see prosperity even when it comes their way. They will dwell in parched places like a desert, in a salt land where no one lives. And then, you know, in verse 7, in the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 17, it turns toward blessing. Like, blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord. This is where you and I want to live, by the way. We want to live as people who trust in the Lord, who are confident in him. The promise here is that those who trust in the Lord and place their confidence in the Lord will be like trees planted by the water. That should sound a lot like Psalm 1. Sending out its roots by the stream. It doesn't fear when the heat comes. Its leaves are always green, this whole producing fruit in and out of season thing. No worries in the year of drought, for it never fails to bear fruit. Remember when Jesus went up to the fig tree and everybody's like, hey, it's not in season. It shouldn't be producing fruit. And Jesus is like, hey, in and out of season, in and out of season, people, in and out of season. And so, yes, there's a time for everything under heaven. But in the economy of God, you and I are supposed to be producing good fruit in every season. In every season, regardless of the wickedness of the generation in which we happen to find ourselves and live. So this is where in verse 9, we reread the verse. Again, this is Jeremiah chapter 17. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? When we talk about the heart of man being desperately wicked, when we talk about the dehumanization and escalation of violence in the days of the judges, when we talk about the dehumanization and escalation of violence described in Romans chapter 1, When everybody does what's right in their own eyes, God actually gives us up to the most base of our desires. When we have exchanged the truth about God for lies, we find ourselves as the beneficiaries of our own demented delusions and pursuits. And I think we have to acknowledge that in our culture today. Anytime that you read the news, you throw up your hands and you say, you know, what is going on? How could this possibly be happening? You need to remember that at the root of violence is sin. At the root of violence is sin. At the root of violence is a broken relationship with the Lord our God, a failure to understand who we are as creatures created in the image of God, and certainly a failure to see other people as sharing that same dignity. So we have a huge sin problem here in the United States of America. We have a huge sin problem around the world, and we have a gracious Savior who came from heaven to earth and then went from earth to the cross and the cross to the grave and the grave to the sky in order that we, in our sin, might know the restored, redemptive love of God in the person of Jesus Christ. As we approach the events of Holy Week, as we approach the cross of Christ, as we approach, yes, Easter, we need to remember that it is sin that nailed him there. It is sin that takes Jesus, right, from the glory of heaven. Like he comes voluntarily. He condescends to our reality. He takes on human flesh in order that he might take on human sin and do away with it at the cross. But the journey from here to there, the journey of recognition of sin, and then the recognition of the redemption offered in Jesus Christ is the journey of Holy Week. And when we come back from our break, I'm going to be joined in conversation by somebody who you know and love. His name is Fernando Ortega. He has been a person who has been taking us to the cross for 25 years. He's a critically acclaimed singer and songwriter. You know him and you love him, and we are going to talk about his latest project called The Crucifixion of Jesus. It was released last fall. It is available at FernandoOrtega.com, and he's going to be right here with me on Connecting Faith to discuss the project when we come back. All right, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, host of Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
Prepare the way, O Zion. Your Christ is drawing near. Let every hill and valley. Your will be done on earth, O Lord, as in heaven. Grant us patience in times of sorrow.
Friends, that melodic voice you're hearing is Fernando Ortega. He is one of Christian music's most respected composers. His works encompass modern hymns, liturgical songs, inspirational and praise worship favorites that many of us sing in our cars and with our iPods accompanying us in all kinds of environments. He's a person who has actually supplied incredible fodder for worship for more than a generation. He's a critically acclaimed singer and songwriter. He's got 3 Gospel Music Association Dove Awards and many other accolades to his credit. And so we are privileged to be joined by Fernando Ortega today to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus, not just the event in history, but actually a project that he's put together that includes 11 songs and 6 tracks of what I'll describe as a spoken word ministry. Fernando, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
So this project feels intensely personal. So I'd like for you to just tell us about the inspiration for the collection, The Crucifixion of Jesus.
It started with, at my the church where I lead worship, Hope EV Free here in Albuquerque, we have this big screen in the front of the church, like a lot of churches do, where we project the scripture passage where the pastor is preaching from or song lyrics. And when it wasn't being used, it was just this blob up there. a gray presence. So I got it in my mind to amass a collection of sacred art images, from the greatest painters of all time and sculptors. And so every Sunday now we project images that pertain to whatever the topic is for the week. But some of the images that meant the most to me were from the Passion of Jesus, the whole thing leading up to his crucifixion, starting with a triumphal entry. So that was the initial inspiration that had me start writing this record. And it's part of a larger project. After crucifixion, we just are going to start working on the resurrection of Jesus, and then we'll do Pentecost, and then I'm going to start over with Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, and Lent. So I think it's 7 records all told.
Wow. Okay, so we look forward to all of that.
yeah, I'll be like 105 when it's done. So.
Well, I think the most exciting thing that you just shared that other people are probably just as like jaw-dropped about as I am is that, okay, you're a worship leader in the rhythm of life of a regular worshiping community. I love that. I love that this project grows out of the heart of a worship leader who is actually, in the context of a congregation. I think that is so important because sometimes I feel like, we're kind of disconnected in terms of the materials or products that are provided for use by the church. And this really just grows out of the life of the church. And so I really appreciate that. And I think that comes across the invitation into real worship, be it personal individual worship or community and congregational worship. I actually feel like this project, or as you call it, a record, provides, literally somebody could just play this as a Holy Week service, and they wouldn't need any singers or songwriters or musicians. You're actually providing them not only the word, the spoken word portions of a service, but all of the music. So talk with me, share with us sort of how an individual and or a congregation might actually use this next week during Holy Week.
Well, it follows a narrative. There are readings interspersed between the songs. And so it ties it all together, and you see the narrative, as I mentioned, of Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem, his cleansing of the temple. There were several events that I just couldn't fit on the record. It was just getting too long. But I think that, because it's modeled after the service that we do every Good Friday at my church, and several of the songs are ones that we use in that service. So I think it works very well as a guide for a small group or for an individual person to put their headphones on and be in a quiet spot and, maybe have their Bibles open, I don't know, but, pause it here and there for prayer. It could also be used, I think, for a small group to have communion with each other because it lends itself to that kind of thinking. It starts with actually early on we have the Last Supper, so I think it's very appropriate for that kind of setting as well.
So you're anticipating my next question, which was about the song In My Father's Kingdom, because it's in that song that you take us into the celebration of the Last Supper. It's an unusual communion hymn. And so invite people into the experience of the first disciples as they, spent not only these days leading up to the Passion of the Christ, but these hours, these particular hours with the Lord at the Last Supper.
Yeah, it's an interesting passage, that one. It's not the one that we always use for communion in church. It's less used. I will not drink of the fruit of this vine until I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. I think Christ, of course, knew what was about to happen. He knew how the disciples would all fail in their devotion to him, and they would all abandon him. And he was urging them. First he was breaking bread with them before they spilled out of into the garden. And he urged them to stay awake with him. So for me, the song is very poignant because when he says, "This bread is my body broken for you," I just can't imagine the weight that was on him at that point and how, even though they were, I'm sure, moved by it, just had no clue about what was about to happen.
Hmm. So I like how you describe that they poured out of the Last Supper into the garden. They make that walk through, through a vineyard to get over to the Garden of Gethsemane, and there are olive trees there, and there's certainly rocky ground in the desert, in that desert landscape, and Jesus begs his disciples. I mean, he's begging them. As you sing, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And then, I mean, we hear Jesus pleading with the disciples, stay with me here and keep watch with me. This pleading image of Jesus to his disciples. You sing it in the voice of the Lord from the garden. It's appropriately foreboding. It's very sad. I just want to ask you personally, what is that like to actually sing as Jesus about the events of his passion?
It's a weird thing because you don't want to cheapen it by some sort of human emotion or some sort of manipulation. That was a very hard thing to negotiate for me, to write a melody that I felt did justice to that. To sing in the voice of the Lord, it's kind of risky, and people have brought it up, but I will always say that most of those vocals I recorded when nobody was around. I was just sitting in my piano and my little setup there with my headphones, and I would, especially that song that you're saying, Stay With Me, and This Bread Is My Body in My Father's Kingdom, both of those songs, it took several months to get it right because I was very emotional during it and had a lot of doubt about whether it was the right thing to do. But in the end, I think it worked out. It's fairly effective,
It's more than fairly effective. It transports, and I won't even describe it as the listener, because I do think that when a person is listening to this particular project, and again, the project that we're talking about, friends, is Fernando Ortega's The Crucifixion of Jesus, 11 contemplative songs and 6 readings that take us through the events of Holy Week, starting at Palm Sunday and arriving at Calvary. It's not just an exercise in listening. It is an invitation into the reality of those events. So, Fernando, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation. Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith, and the music as we go into this break is actually from this record. Again, it's The Crucifixion of Jesus, and you can find it at fernandoortega.com.
This bread is my body, broken for you. This cup is my blood of the covenant, stricken, smitten, and afflicted. See him dying on the tree. 'Tis the Christ by man rejected. Yes, my soul, 'tis he, 'tis he. 'Tis the long expected prophet, David's son, yet David's Lord. By his son God now has spoken, 'tis the true and faithful word.
Friends, that melodic voice and that truthful proclamation is coming from Fernando Ortega, one of Christian music's most respected composers. And we are privileged to have him with us here on Connecting Faith to talk about this project, this record, The Crucifixion of Jesus. It includes not only tracks like the one that you just heard, but also portions of spoken word where Fernando is reading direct excerpts from scripture or other excerpt excerpted material. I love the one from Holy Living, by the way. And it's woven together in such a way that it's a companion for us during Holy Week. It takes us from the events of Palm Sunday to Calvary, as you just heard in that particular song. So, Fernando, welcome again to Connecting Faith. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm trying to imagine, singing about the things about which you're singing and singing it in the voice of Jesus, and the experience, particularly in terms of what happens on the cross. So, oh, great love, now crucified. I want you to talk about the cross and what it means to you and why you put together a project to help people get there.
I guess, answer that by saying that after being a Christian all my life, really, but I mean, I really coming to faith when I was around 14, but being in the church before that, the biggest lesson that I keep coming back to is the beginning place is a place that is largely negative. The poor in spirit, the way the Beatitudes start, the way that we reapproach God on our knees and with our head bowed and acknowledging our sin. And a lot of people, when I was recording this record and putting those images together of Christ on the cross and being tortured and all those, they're beautiful paintings, by the way, but people would say, why would you want to camp out on this for so long? At least put one song about the resurrection at the end of the record so it won't be so hopeless. But really, it's the starting place. There, the gospel begins there. Death to ourselves, death to sin, and then Christ raising us to new life. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to camp out on this subject and make a full record about it. I thought it would be super challenging, and it was. But the best place to start.
So the readings are as powerful as the music. And I don't want people to miss that this is a project that's woven together. It has 11 tracks that are sung, but it has 6 tracks that are spoken. And that weaving together is a very powerful experience in terms of a worship rhythm. And so I really appreciated that in listening to this. And yet, Psalm 22 is not something you read. It's something you sing. And that was, I will just tell you, that might have been, like, it's probably wrong to say it was my favorite track because it seems wrong to have that be a favorite. But Psalm 22, in the way it's presented here in this project, it took me to my knees. And I just want you to know that. I want you to know the kind of ministry that that this has for individuals. And you and I both know that, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. And so when you are singing the scripture, I'll just tell you that that might have been the most impactful part of this project to me.
That's interesting that you say that. That song came about last year, last Good Friday. My pastor, who's very spontaneous, he's a young fellow, and just before the service, maybe a few hours before, he said, when we get to that psalm, instead of reading it, can you just chant it? So I had to come up with music, within a couple of hours. And so I did. And that night, I think everybody came up and said the same thing that you just said. That was the most powerful part. And I did it on that night without an instrument accompanying me. It was just completely a cappella. And on this record, it's the strings vibrating on a piano. I hit the chords, but we didn't record the strike of the keys. We just recorded the aftermath. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then sort of looped it together to make it this feel of intense emotion. So I'm really glad to hear you say what you said.
So folks can they can go to fernandoortega.com and actually buy the whole project. I will tell you, folks, if you want a little taste, a little sampling, you know, there's some of it up on YouTube. And so if you need a taste before you go and partake of the entire feast, but let me just tell you, you're going to want it. You're going to want the whole thing because you're going to want to have this companion for your Holy Week journey all the way from Palm Sunday to Good Friday. And it is something that you can use as an individual. It's something that you could use in your small group. It's something that you could use as a companion for family worship next Thursday, next Friday. I don't know what you have planned in your own family for how you are going to attend to the events of Holy Week and how you're going to invite your children into this journey that Jesus takes, not just from, you know, sort of the glorious proclamation of the hosannas of Palm Sunday and the waving palm branches to the very reality of his flesh nailed to a cross for our sin. But I'm a person who appreciates having some help with that. And so we have a worship leader here in Fernando Ortega who has provided for all of us a companion for that experience. The project is called The Crucifixion of Jesus. And again, you can get it at fernandoortega.com. Before I let you go, you have given us a glimpse of what's to come. So you've told us that there's a reason that this collection ends at Calvary. There's no Easter here. And so tell us about when we can expect to have a similar project related to the resurrection.
Gosh, I'm so hesitant to say because this project took me at least a year to record. And then I was really floundering with writer's block and all that. A friend of mine, Bernard Chadwick, who is an art professor and a really fine musician in California, came in and just kind of prodded me on to finish up. So it was a collaboration with him. So we have scheduled time now to write for the next project, the Resurrection of Jesus, next month. So we're going to camp out in a house up in California on the coast and bring keyboards and recording stuff and his guitars and his drums and all that. And I'm hoping it'll take less than a year. So hopefully by spring, a year from now, hopefully it'll be out. That's my plan.
Well, that's a good plan. And we can certainly be praying with you and for you in that direction. And, you know, certainly want to encourage you as a worship leader. I think that oftentimes we, sort of the people of the church, the people in the pews, we forget how much work there is related to the right leading of people into worship. So maybe speak a word of encouragement before we go today to worship leaders and pastors who are right now preparing for the most hectic week of the year. Give them a word of encouragement as we close our conversation.
Boy, my word of encouragement is because it's a very difficult season to endure. It's a hard week for all of us in the church as we camp out on these scriptures, these passages, try and figure out how to present this stuff to our congregation and a culture with short attention spans. And my encouragement is just to stay the course, like Eugene Peterson's great book, A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And that's what this season requires, you know, that kind of focus.
Fernando Ortega, thank you for the 25 years of long obedience. You have been moving in the same direction to offer all of us the kind of worship music that actually draws us to the foot of the cross. Again, friends, the project is The Crucifixion of Jesus. You can find it at fernandoortega.com. Thanks for being with us today on Connecting Faith. All right, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. We have back with us our friend from Biola, Tim Muehlhoff. And I would like to be telling you that the book we're going to talk about today is I Beg to Differ, because I got it from Tim a couple of weeks ago, and I devoured it. And so I'm planning on asking him some questions related to that. he's planning on talking about emotional contagion. So there you go. Tim, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Great to be with you.
All right. So it seems like everywhere we turn, there's conflict, right? I mean, it doesn't really matter which direction we turn. Conflict in the nation, conflict between nations, sometimes very real conflict in our families. Every subject seems totally politicized. Every conversation turns into this like polarized defense of intractable positions. Tell us how we get there and how we get out of that.
Well, Carmen, it's a great question. We often sabotage conversations even before they start. Psychologists have noted something called emotional contagion, which means that the emotions you have inside yourself, the thoughts you have about another person, you may keep those quiet. You may not verbalize the fact that you're really mad at a person or that you don't think very highly of a person or you have a negative stereotype of a person, but you think, you know, I'm okay because I'm not going to say it to this person. They won't ever know that I'm really angry at them and disrespect them and things like that. Well, psychologists say those negative emotions, just like a flu virus, have already bled out into the communication climate and have poisoned the conversation before it even starts because that person's picking up on it. So let me tell you about an interesting study that rocked communication theorists. The study was we took a bunch of people, put them in an auditorium, and they listened to a speaker give a talk. Then they ranked that speaker on a questionnaire, you know, 1 to 10, what you think about the speaker and all that kind of stuff. Well, then they were put into a waiting room, two people, and they were told you cannot talk to each other during this five-minute period. Now, one person is in on the study. That person is told, I want you to think continually negative thoughts about the speaker. You're just not allowed to say a word to the other person. Well, then, Carmen, they bring him back in, and they say, hey, we just want you to re-rate the speaker. You're not going to listen to the speaker again. We just want you to re-rate the speaker. And would you know that 68% of the time, the person who sat in a room with a person just thinking negative thoughts actually lowered his or her score of the speaker just being in a room with a person thinking negative thoughts about the speaker? That's how emotional contagion works, is my negative feelings towards you actually bleed out onto you and you change and pick up on it and the conversation is dead on arrival.
Okay, so I feel like parents instinctively know this. I mean, you know, we sort of like know that our emotional energy and what we're thinking about and either the, you know, the bad attitude or the good attitude we show up with when we pull in the driveway, we pretty much know that that is going to overwhelm the, as you described it, communication climate in our homes.
Right.
Like, we all instinctively know that. And so it's very interesting that, you know, there's like actual research to back that up. I guess I have a sense of like feeling it when I walk into an environment where you're like, oh, wow, this environment has like a negative feel to it. And what you're saying is that's actually
absolutely.
Like genuinely produced by the people in the room.
Right. And so here's the thing. I have kids as well, Carmen. So when my kids were teenagers, my goodness, right, you just throw your hands up in the air because you're like teenagers. You know, Mark Twain said, I have three boys, Carmen. Mark Twain said, when a boy turns 11, stick him in a barrel and cut out a breathing hole. When he turns 15, plug up a hole. That's Mark Twain. That's what Mark Twain said. So you know, if you have these negative feelings towards your teenage son or daughter, you can't fake it. That's what the psychologists are saying. So I could sit in my car and I could say, okay, I cannot walk in this room. And when I can't walk in the house and when nothing is cleaned, I'm going to hit DEFCON 1 in a heartbeat. I'm just going to fake it. I'm going to put a smile on my face. I'm going to say, hey, it's so great to see you, when I actually don't feel that way. This is what emotional contagion is telling us, is your kids, even though your mouth is saying one thing, they pick up on the negative feelings, and it bleeds in, and immediately they're on the defensive, they feel judged. So what we need to do today in political discourse or when we're talking with people we disagree with, it's not that we can fake it. It's what we need to do is actually have concern for our neighbors, actually respect and admire certain people. And until we're ready to do that, maybe we're not ready to have these disagreements. The book of Proverbs talks more about the timing of our communication than anything else. It says words spoken in the right circumstances are like fine jewelry, right? So we can't fake neighbor love. We can't fake respect. So better not to have a conversation with a person until you can negotiate your emotions so that at least you're at a bit of a neutrality towards a person, not the issue, but towards a person. Maybe we better not have these conversations so quickly because we're going to poison it because of the emotions we carry into the room.
All right, friends, we're talking with Tim Muehlhoff from Biola about how our emotions actually affect the conversational communication environment or climate into which we enter. And we take all of that with us, and somebody else is bringing everything they're bringing with them. And so maybe it shouldn't be such a great surprise that some of the conversations we're trying to have today over very contentious or difficult moral and social issues, maybe it shouldn't be such a great surprise that we're having a hard time doing that in a way that's civil.
Right. And so what we're going to have to do is change how I think about people, right? If my next-door neighbor, let's say, all I do is have continual negative thoughts about my neighbor, right? There's one thing that just drives me crazy about this neighbor. Well, that's called tunnel vision. It's best to step back and say, but surely my neighbor isn't wrong A to Z. What are the positive things my neighbor does? Now, here's the problem we get into with political discourse, Cameron, is we do look at the person across the aisle and we think there is nothing good about this person. And I would argue, boy, that tells me a lot about your psychological frame of mind, because I don't think anybody's all good and I don't think anybody's all bad. We're so much more nuanced than that. So I think we need to really look hard for what we call counterfactual information, which means information about you that goes against my stereotype or my judgment, and I need to look. And if I can't find it, I need to find people who can bring that to me, right? To say, hey, look, I have a negative attitude towards my neighbor. Are there things about my neighbor you see that I don't see? And a person would say, oh, yeah, remember the time they threw that Halloween party, or they, right, things that I've forgotten or overlooked. Other people can say, hey, listen, you can't demonize your neighbor. I get that you're frustrated, but there are things that your neighbor does that is good. We need to make sure we're open to those kind of voices and perspectives, or otherwise we're always going to be prejudiced. We're always going to be angry and see no good in what a person does.
All right. So I'm thinking about, you know, situations and relationships in my own life. I'm thinking about people with whom it is hard to have conversations about certain things. And I guess, Tim, you know, I will acknowledge that at some point in my own discipleship, you know, God moved me from the place where I sort of, you know, saw other people as adversaries because of their positions on certain things. And instead, you know, God sort of reminded me, hey, you know, you're a complicated mess as well. And you tend to be illogical and inconsistent and don't always perfectly apply my word in every aspect of life. Like, right? You've been a hearer of the word a really long time, and there's some ways in which you're not a doer of it. Part of this is seeing ourselves rightly as well. I think we tend to see other people. We see all their flaws and all of their imperfections and all the things that, you know, that they're saying or doing that aren't rightly aligned. This is the plank and the speck conversation.
Oh, completely. Yeah, I think you're right. We speak at marriage conferences, and so sometimes between the sessions, the talks, couples will come up to us. And they'll be frustrated. I get that. I've been married 28 years. I know what it's like to be frustrated. But when they get into a certain narrative is where you need to challenge it. Like one woman said to me, Carmen, she said, my husband doesn't do anything for this marriage, anything. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, hey, can I ask you a quick question? Is he here at this conference? And she said, yes. I said, well, isn't that one thing? And Carmen, she said to me, and walked away, just walked away. But we can get to that place where we see no good. And I think I would say to her, hey, what are the things you do to contribute to arguments? And if a person looks at me and says, oh, I don't do anything to contribute to the argument, it's the other person completely, then I think that's tunnel vision. And I very seldom meet a spouse or a neighbor who does no good, and I do no bad. I think that's a bias that we tend to have towards ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, can I ask you one more question? And I know you and I get together frequently, and so we can talk about this question again at another point in time. But I want to talk about how and why the word compromise is now such a dirty word in terms of our civil discourse with one another.
Well, we've gotten this from two directions. One, the political discourse today on Capitol Hill is so negative that the mere acknowledgement of the good points of a person perspective is seen as compromise, and then compromise itself, right? Is you need to toe the political line A to Z. And I think as Christians, we've kind of fallen into this as well, is that we think non-Christian writers can offer no positive perspectives, that you can't learn from a non-Christian. So compromise is like, what do you do in reading that person's book? What do you do in listening to that perspective? The mere fact that we listen to it is seen as compromise. And again, we need to be very careful of doing that. We have great church examples of Aquinas learning from Plato, so things like that. So we need to be very careful of the mere fact that I'm reaching out to you and learning from you is not compromise. It involves discernment, for sure. Mm-hmm. But compromise, we've allowed it to have a negative connotation via politics and even some unfortunate ways Christians approach non-Christians, that any acknowledgement of a good perspective from another religion or belief system is seen as compromise. We need to really we need to reclaim that word.
Well, and I think a part of that is recognizing, you know, the old-fashioned concept of common grace, that there are, you know, like God reveals himself in all of creation. And so, you know, in Romans, it characterizes that as, you know, therefore we're without excuse. But the other way of seeing that, the other way of understanding that is God's truth is revealed in virtually everything, because you can't escape the reality of who he is and the influence that he has on many, many things. And so we should be able to actually find evidence of the truth of God in all kinds of places. We just need to be the people who then point that out and draw that out and help other people then connect that reality to the reality of God.
And Carmen, I agree with that, but that is not our reputation as Christians. Our reputation is we always start with how we disagree with a person. And I like what you're saying is let's flip that and start by saying, hey, listen, I agree with you on this perspective. I think you're right in this area. So all of comp theory can be distilled into the idea, start with areas of agreement and work towards areas of disagreement. And I think that's really biblical, right? Remember Paul on Mars Hill? He hates idols. He says that all throughout Acts. Yet when he talks to the men of Athens who worship idols, what does he say? He says, men of Athens, I see that you're men of worship. Now, he believes their worship is misguided, but he starts by saying, I'm going to acknowledge the fact that you're serious about worship, and I'm also serious about worship. And then he gets to talking about how idols are misplaced. So I think we need to start with people to say, hey, I care about marriage just like you do. I care about this country just like you do. We all care about our community. We all care about the American flag, whether we kneel or stand during the anthem. We all care about the flag. So start with positives and then work towards the negatives. In today's argument culture, we literally flip that. We always start with the negatives, and then we wind up with these really uncivil conversations.
Tim Muehlhoff, you always give us great stuff to think about. We look forward to connecting with you again in the future here on Connecting Faith. Friends, we are just about out of time today. Thank you for tuning in. Those of you who are listening live, those of you who are listening via streaming, those of you listening on the Faith Radio app, hey, if you're new to all of this and you want to know more, we've actually got a welcome packet filled with information and encouraging content. You can visit myfaithradio.com, request your free welcome packet today. All right, friends, we're also, as always, giving away a study Bible. Right now, it's the CSB Disciples Study Bible. Email me at carmen@myfaithradio.com, and we'll get you one of those. All right, friends, thanks for joining me today on Connecting Faith. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.